This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what are the ramifications of the U.S. and coalition troop withdrawal from Afghanistan? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. According to the February 2020 U.S. Taliban peace deal negotiated by the Trump administration, U.S. troops, which have been in Afghanistan for 20 years, were expected to withdraw by May 1st, 2021. However, in view of the uptick in violence from the Taliban and its failure to adhere to the spirit, if not the letter of the agreement, many analysts thought that U.S. President Joe Biden might decide to maintain the current contingent of approximately 2,500 U.S. troops. But on April 14, President Biden announced he would withdraw American troops over the coming months, completing the military exit by the 20th anniversary of the September 11, 2001 attacks that prompted the United States to retaliate against the al-Qaeda perpetrators who found safe haven in the then Taliban-controlled Afghanistan. In his April address, Biden explained that after 20 years, the terrorist threat has become more dispersed and has metastasized around the globe. He said, quote, "With the terror threat now in many places, keeping thousands of troops grounded and concentrated in just one country and across the billions of dollars spent each year makes little sense to me and to our leaders," closed quote. What factors drove the administration to make this decision? What are the implications for the stability of Afghanistan and the rights of women and minorities in the country? And how will withdrawal affect the U.S. capacity to pursue an effective counterterrorism strategy? With us via Microsoft Teams to discuss these issues are two distinguished regional analysts. Lisa Curtis is a senior fellow and director of the Indo-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. That's a policy group here in Washington. Prior to this post, Lisa served as deputy assistant to the president and senior director for South and Central Asia at the National Security Council during the Trump administration. And Andrew Watkins, he is senior analyst for Afghanistan at the International Crisis Group. That's a think tank dedicated to preventing conflict around the world. Before joining Crisis Group, Andrew worked as a political affairs officer for the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan, and both guests joined me via Microsoft Teams. Lisa Curtis, welcome back to the program.
Well, it's great to be back. Thanks, Carol.
And Andrew, it's a delight to welcome you to the show.
It's great to join you both, Carol. Thank you for having me.
Lisa, let me start with you. Again, the Biden administration says that in terms of investing force posture, they believe there are other priorities that merit that investment, you know, after 20 years. But what's your reaction, Lisa, to this decision? And do you see any kind of correlation between the start of the troop withdrawal on May 1 and then this escalation of violence, including, of course, the horrific attack outside a school for girls in Kabul last week?
Well, thanks, Carol. I've said on many occasions, I think that President Biden's decision to withdraw all U.S. troops by September really is a mistake. And I think I agree with General Petraeus' characterization of this announcement as an unforced error. You know, we had already right-sized our troop presence to about 3,200 troops. And our NATO partners were willing to stay on with us. So I don't think it was necessary to withdraw all U.S. troops. And I do see that we have seen an increase in violence. And it's looking increasingly clear that the Taliban are not interested in a negotiated settlement, that they probably used the February 2020 Doha agreement to merely get U.S. forces and international forces to withdraw and to obtain the release of their prisoners from Afghan jails. As you recall, President Ghani released 5,000 Taliban prisoners last year and got very little in return. So I'm quite pessimistic on what the future of Afghanistan looks like now that this decision has been made. And I'm also disappointed that we haven't really seen the administration develop a plan B. And by that, I mean, so much was riding on this peace agreement with the Taliban that looks like, you know, is not going to hold. And there needs to be a rethink rather than continuing to put all of our diplomatic resources and efforts into chasing this elusive peace deal, we should be thinking about how we can support the Afghan forces. What do we need to do? Do we need to offshore forces? We need to think about how we're going to continue our financial support to the Afghan security forces, as well as our economic support, working with our European partners, and start focusing on how we still protect U.S. national security interests, which aren't going away. We're ending U.S. involvement in the war, but the war is certainly not ending.
Well, turning to you, Andrew Watkins, for your take, do you think it was a mistake, the fact that Biden has announced this withdrawal and that the withdrawal is actually going forward, an unforced error? How do you see it?
Thanks, Carol. Without dodging the question entirely, I want to reframe it a little bit. You asked about what the rising violence from the Taliban since this announcement shows us. And I think it goes back to the very important point that Lisa just made, which is that the war is not ending just because American involvement might be. But the flip side of that coin is that the violence wouldn't necessarily drop any if U.S. forces had stayed. And so this was the real conundrum that not just President Biden and his team faced, but the U.S. intervention has faced from the beginning. There are very real concerns among Afghans, among regional states, in the U.S. national security sphere about what could happen now that the decision has been made to withdraw military force. And probably a lot of U.S. capabilities will change and diminish as a result. But the fact is, the country has seen so much violence, even with a quote-unquote right-sized troop presence, with an estimate of tens of thousands of combatants killed every year for the last 5 years, 10,000 civilians either killed or wounded for the past 10 years. And the fact is, the increase in Taliban violence that we see this May, even had American troops stayed with a commitment to the Afghan government, either for a limited amount of time or perhaps a conditions-based, undefined time period, the Taliban were going to increase their violence anyway. This is all a part of what has now become a cyclical conflict, which is almost always ramped up in the spring and summer fighting seasons, as they're called in Afghanistan. For me, this is the counterbalance, though it's an incredibly important decision that the Biden team has made. It's also important to remember that under the United States' watch and under the supposed protection of the United States and its forces and all the support that it gives to the Afghan government, the conflict in Afghanistan nonetheless became the world's deadliest under the United States' watch. And to go back to the energy that the U.S. has put into its peace efforts, I agree with Lisa, absolutely. But I implicitly hear in Biden's announcement of the U.S. withdrawal an admission that those peace efforts actually were not proving effective, just as Lisa describes, that the likelihood of the Taliban coming to an agreement, what I hear in the Biden administration's decision is an admission that it's true. That was probably very unlikely. Where they seem to differ is their determination that the U.S. could do less about it in terms of steering the direction of the conflict.
That's a very interesting point, Andrew. Back to you, Lisa Curtis. One might ask, after 20 years, what are the impediments to basically countering the threat that the Taliban poses, as well as some other terrorist organizations? Why has the Afghan government and the armed forces, with all the training and backstopping, why have they been unable to, in a sense, govern themselves, to establish some modicum of stability beyond the large cities, beyond Kabul?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and it has a multifaceted answer. One is the failure of the sort of Afghan political elite to come together, to unify, and to root out corruption and function in a way that they're providing services to the people and acting like a government should be. So I think that has been a shortfall. People are disappointed with the government. But second is we never saw the Taliban denied their sanctuary in Pakistan. They continued to be able to regenerate from their Pakistani safe haven. They continued to receive support and, you know, help in crossing the border from Pakistan into Afghanistan. The leadership remains protected inside Pakistan. So that is a major factor. We have to sort of reckon with the thought that Pakistan, they're not an ally. They have been supporting the Taliban all these years. They've played a double game, and everybody knows that. But if we're going to start pointing fingers, one of those fingers has to be pointed at Pakistan. And third, I think the U.S. has made mistakes, I think, in its approach. We've tried several different ways to support the Afghans and to strengthen the Afghan security forces, try to make sure that the Afghan government can hold on to provincial capitals. But somehow the U.S. strategy was not effective. And I think we have to think about that. And what were the mistakes that the U.S. made? And how can we do better in the future? And again, I'll just reiterate, now that this decision has been made, even though I have stated clearly, I don't think it was a necessary thing to do. And I think there could be some regret. I think President Biden may regret his decision within a year's time or so. But now that we're here, we have to think about how we continue to protect U.S. national security interests, mainly prevent the reemergence of a terrorist safe haven, because that threat is not going away. Are we going to have troops based in neighboring countries? You know, we can work more closely with other governments in the region. And are we going to support not just the Afghan security forces, but are there other Afghans, militias that are going to start arming themselves that we would contemplate supporting? You know, I think we need to work through all of this. And unfortunately, there are no good answers coming from the administration right now. I think this decision was made quickly. I think the military was hoping this was not the decision that was made. And so now everybody is scrambling to try to implement this decision. And there hasn't been a lot of energy and thought going into what is the plan B. And like I said, I think we've hung on to this illusion that Taliban's going to play nice and make a peace deal. And we need to let go of that so that we can start focusing on other strategies that will help protect U.S. interests.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Lisa Curtis, from whom you just heard. She's former senior advisor for South Asia on the U.S. National Security Council, now senior fellow and director of the Indo-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security here in Washington. And Andrew Watkins, he's senior analyst for Afghanistan at the International Crisis Group. And we're discussing the ramifications of the U.S. and coalition troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a new listener and Twitter fan, Mohammed Omar from Sudan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to Andrew Watt for your response. Andrew, Lisa makes an interesting point about counterterrorism. You talked about how violence in Afghanistan would have continued whether or not U.S. troops left or stayed. It happened, you know, while we were there. It's happening now. But there is this counterterrorism aspect, and preventing Afghanistan from being a safe haven for terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and, of course, Islamic State. Some analysts are saying that the pullout could permit a diminished Al-Qaeda threat to actually regroup. And then what about Pakistan and the role of Pakistan in its double role?
Thanks, Carol. Lisa's absolutely right to point to this. And I think the consensus among most observers is, including, it seems, from agencies and members of Biden's foreign policy team, is that there definitely is risk to a resurgence or an evolution of the terrorism landscape in Afghanistan as a result of the withdrawal. listeners should note that Al-Qaeda has had a presence in Afghanistan for longer than the Taliban has even existed, that Al-Qaeda was a staple within the landscape of resistance to Soviet occupation and earlier eras of Afghan history before the Taliban really formally came into being. And the odd relationship that has often been partnership between the two entities is not so easily split. And there was a lot of hope from the US's side that in its agreement with the Taliban, they might eventually be able to get them to denounce Al-Qaeda. And it's fascinating when you look at the text of the agreement of the US-Taliban deal signed last February, that in the end, the United States was not able to extract a clear public denunciation of the group. Even after everything that the Taliban has suffered over 20 years of being driven out of government and out of power, to flee to Pakistan, to have been hunted and persecuted by U.S. and international forces, at the end of all of that, a denunciation of Al-Qaeda was not forthcoming. And I think that tells us a lot. The Taliban wound up promising the United States that they would keep a check on Al-Qaeda and any other foreign terrorist groups that might be operating in parts of Afghanistan that the Taliban control. Of course, the problem with this is that sounds very similar to what the government of the Taliban, the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, was telling the United States and many other world powers back in the 1990s. It's absolutely still an open question as to whether there are any incentives, diplomatic, economic, in terms of development support, that the U.S. and the international community can use as incentives and as carrots to pull the Taliban away, not just from Al-Qaeda, but from the ideological universe of jihadism and the sense of brotherhood with other people who commit themselves to these ideas of violent struggle that has bound these groups for decades now. So there is definitely a concern that as the U.S. pulls back and potentially more space opens up for the Taliban, that there will also be more space for Al-Qaeda and these other groups. But we have to remember that just as the Taliban were given sanctuary for decades in Pakistan, a lot of Pakistan is poorly governed space where many militant groups operate, either independently without being pursued by the Pakistani government. And then there's also a category that are often reported to be working in tandem with or supported by the Pakistani government for their potential use in a proxy war with India and in other existing regional tensions. There really is a landscape of violent extremism and terrorism, again, that has already existed. Whether or not a safe haven environment returns in Afghanistan will depend on what the United States does moving forward. And on this, I agree with Lisa. Attention has to be turned back towards ensuring some level of stability in Afghanistan. And on the United States' part, that has to come in renewed support to the Afghan government. That's a very tricky proposition because, as she noted, and as many analysts agree, the weaknesses of the Afghan government and the lack of its legitimacy in much of the countryside is in part what fed into the resilience of the Taliban insurgency. And there are weaknesses inherent to the Afghan government that go back to the first days of our intervention. But right now, some of the worst possible outcomes will only come after a scenario of state collapse. And the United States has to be determined to prevent that. And that does mean continuing its support for the government in Kabul.
Back to you, Lisa. It's a very dire scenario. And one can see why many analysts have argued for maintaining a troop presence there. The numbers aren't that much more or the same as U.S. troops, perhaps in South Korea and other places. But nonetheless, this is the decision. And I'd like to get your take very quickly as we close the program. To what extent can the Afghan government and the Afghan security forces contain the Taliban without U.S. air support? Many analysts are saying this could be very challenging. Can they, you know, hold back? Because the Taliban seems to be advancing and wanting to capture more and more territory and control.
Yes, I'm afraid I'm fairly pessimistic. You know, I could see the Afghan government falling within a year's time. And what we've seen is the Taliban have been sort of amassing around provincial capitals. And the only thing that has really stopped them from being able to take over these provincial capitals is the U.S. would send in air support for the Afghan forces. So without that air support, I'm very pessimistic that the Afghan security forces can remain in control of these provincial capitals, particularly in the south. We already see the Taliban closing in on cities like Lashkargah. We have seen in Kandahar, they have made quite a few gains in the last few days. So really, I think it's only a matter of time before the Taliban is able to take over Kandahar, Helmand, and other areas in the southern part of the country. So I think the situation is dire, and the U.S. should continue to provide as much air support, as well as financial support, training, battlefield advice, as they can possibly do over the next several months. Because otherwise, I fear that the Taliban are going to be able to retake the country even more quickly than people have been fearing.
Andrew Watkins, do you also fear that the Taliban could take over the country much more quickly without the U.S. air support?
It's true that the U.S. air support has at times been the only thing standing between Taliban seizure of some of these provincial capitals. And we've seen that, you know, longer than just recently as peace efforts were ongoing. We saw it most dramatically in 2015 as the Taliban actually did manage to capture the capital of Kunduz province up in the northern part of the country, which is not traditionally a Taliban stronghold. So this has been a struggle and a danger in the conflict for quite some time. I actually see the Taliban facing difficulties and hurdles that don't make it inevitable for them to overtake the country. But I would come back to something I said a moment ago, that all of the worst case scenarios in Afghanistan will hinge on the collapse or the fracturing of the Afghan government, which just underscores how vital it is for the U.S. to continue providing whatever support it can. What I mean is, it's true that the Taliban are encircling Kandahar, for instance, one of Afghanistan's largest cities, in addition to a number of other smaller capitals. How many police does it take to manage law and order in Kandahar? How many military forces do the Afghan security elements themselves have to dedicate to holding the Taliban at bay? If the Taliban were to make military advances that are dramatic, it would be up to them to police the city, possibly even against a hostile population. It would be up to them to defend territory the way that a conventional military force has to. The Taliban have honed their skills and their strengths, but as a guerrilla fighting force, as an insurgency, over the last 20 years. And I'm not at all convinced that they are ready in an immediate moment to transition over to a conventional force that fights and holds and then effectively governs territory. They haven't demonstrated that capacity. Unfortunately, that doesn't mean that life is going to be any better for Afghan civilians. What the Taliban do, it may not be a swift takeover of the country, but what they're aiming for is the swift collapse of the Afghan government. And that's going to hinge on political factors. That's going to hinge on whether all of the other power brokers in Afghanistan continue to have faith in the government. And in turn, that's going to hinge on whether the United States has faith in the government. The sad truth is, many of the achievements and many of the improvements in Afghans' lives that the Western intervention has been able to encourage and to support over the last 20 years have only reached as far as the umbrella of Western security forces and their Afghan allies. But there are small glimmers of hope that as regressive and as socially conservative and as brutal and violent as the Taliban and other actors are, and it's true that they are also being leaned on by a new generation of Afghans who do expect basic services, health, a minimum of education, a decent life and standard of living. just late last year, UNICEF was able to enter into a historic agreement with the Taliban to provide bare levels of education for all Afghan boys and girls living under Taliban territory. That's something that would have been unthinkable with this group 20 years ago. It's not enough, and it doesn't forgive anything that this group does, but that has to be part of the roadmap going forward.
That's all the time we have on this Afghan edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Lisa Curtis, former senior national security official, now director of the Indo-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Andrew Watkins, senior analyst for Afghanistan at the International Crisis Group. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.